Hello and welcome to the True Travel Podcast with me, Laura Sanders. You may have noticed that there was no new episode last week, and that was to respect the period of national mourning here in the UK following the death of Queen Elizabeth II. I'm sure wherever you are in the world, you'll have heard this sad news and watched as the Queen was laid to rest on Monday after 70 years on the throne. Perhaps you have memories of her visiting your country, or you might have been to London to visit Buckingham Palace. The Queen herself was a well-travelled woman. It's thought she'd been to 117 countries and covered over 1 million miles in her lifetime. And some of these countries have been visited by my guest this week, Mary Novakovic. Mary is a British travel journalist specialising in Croatia and the Balkans. Both her parents are originally from Croatia, which at the time of their births was part of Yugoslavia. Mary's memoir, My Family and Other Enemies, was released in August this year and documents her many journeys to visit family in Lika, where her mother was born and raised. And then later, she went back with her mother and then her husband. Having witnessed how this country has changed over the decades, her memoir gives a personal account of a moment in history. But it's above all else a travelogue, which talks of the breathtaking scenery and authentic cultural experiences on offer. And so Mary is here to tell us all about the book and her other adventures, as well as sharing tips for getting off the beaten path in Croatia. As always, I love to hear from you, so please do leave behind a rating and review or get in touch on social media. Mary, it's lovely to have you on the podcast with me and to talk about your exciting new book. How are you? How have you been and how's travel been throughout the pandemic, first of all?
Thank you for having me, Laura. It's travel during the pandemic for me actually hasn't really stopped, bizarrely. I was in Croatia, funnily enough, in early July. And I was in Croatia last summer and also the summer before. I just seemed to find to have very good timing when they had things like travel windows. Remember those?
Yes.
And I used to jump through one as soon as a country opened up. I just went.
Oh, lucky you. I wasn't that lucky. I had so many trips cancelled. So I'm glad someone got away anyway. Before we come on to talking about your memoir, which of course is all about Croatia and where your family's come from, just tell me a little bit about you first. You know, what got you into travel and becoming a travel journalist? What inspired that?
Well, I've been a straightforward journalist, as it were, as in not focusing on travel for at least 35 years. And working in news and working in television and working in all sorts of different genres. I was at the BBC for 8 years and then I went freelance in 1997. 25 years, funnily enough. Nice way to cap my quarter century as a freelance by writing my first travelogue. But I'd been working at The Independent on Sunday doing shifts. And one day in 1999, the travel editor, the late great Jeremy Atiyah, we were chatting away as we do, and he said, I want you to write for me. And I said, yeah, all right, fine, I'd love to. And that then just sort of started things. And I was doing, you know, travel writing in addition to, news subbing and TV writing and TV previews and music writing and the usual mix of things. I had book editing, did loads of books that you do as a freelance. But travel is the one that has stuck and has been lasting the longest.
That's amazing. And other than Croatia, where else have you traveled to? Have you got any particularly memorable trips?
Well, yes, I go to France all the time. France is probably more visited than Croatia in a way, and because it's just so easy just to hop across. And Italy, a lot of time spent in Italy as well. And North America, Canada, US, although I haven't been to the US, well, since Trump, hope to go soon at some point. But mainly European countries, and also other countries within former Yugoslavia, Serbia, go there all the time. And Bosnia, Montenegro, and Switzerland, a lot of Switzerland as well, Austria, just mainly European places.
Lovely. I think a lot of us don't appreciate what we have on our doorstep here in the UK. I certainly don't appreciate it. And Montenegro is definitely on my list. So I'll be coming to you for any advice there. So let's talk a little bit about your book and what inspired it then. So for those listening, Mary, you've written a book, a memoir really, about Croatia, about where your parents grew up. You took your mom back there a couple of times, you know, to pick up those memories of when she was there during the Second World War. And see what she could remember, and to see how the landscape has changed as well, and how it's eventually become a tourism destination, and all of these interesting things sort of rolled up into one in your book. What inspired it, first of all? I know originally you were going to do a radio documentary about it, weren't you? And it sort of evolved from there. So what inspired it originally?
Well, originally, actually, it was going to be a book. I was sitting with my mother in Belgrade on a trip, and we were talking about going to Lika, which is the region where both my parents were born. And we thought, well, let's go there next summer. This is back in 2009, when we decided to go there one summer and do a proper mother-daughter road trip for several weeks, which we set out from Belgrade. And that was the idea then, was doing a book off from that road trip. And then a friend of mine at BBC said, you know, might make a good radio documentary with your mother's wartime memories, because the whole thing of getting old people before they go and getting their stories before it's too late, and that the whole sort of spirit of it. And unfortunately, my mother didn't really pay ball. She was desperate to, she loved the idea of me writing a book. She liked the idea of the radio documentary, but she just didn't want to talk. She just wanted to go and sit and gossip with her friends and just drink cups and cups of Turkish coffee and knock back shots of plum brandy. She didn't really want to give me all the stories that she said she was going to give me. And I finally had to sort of worm them out of her. And it was quite difficult. And at the end of that trip, I realized I haven't got enough for a book. And then 2 years later, my husband and I then went and did all the things that my mother and I couldn't do in 3 weeks. My husband and I did like in several days, because we worked together as a team. He's a photographer. So we're used to going somewhere and just getting the job done. And then after that, I did start writing it, didn't get very far with it, and then shelved it. And it was only, it was actually 3 years ago, 2019, that I was having a conversation with a man who then became my agent, Tom Cole, and just talking about my travels in Lika, from the first time I was there in 1976 as a child to the last time I was there in 2019. And he thought perhaps that could be then turned into a book, sort of chronicles of more than 40 years of travels and your family's history, and also what Croatia, how it's changed, what's happened to it in that time, how it's evolving. And he took me on, and I thought, brilliant. So like The World and His Wife, I wrote it during lockdown. There's a shock.
Amazing. Yes, I chuckled a bit as I was reading it, and you getting frustrated with your mother, who insisted on seeing every cousin, every auntie, everyone. Mine would be the same.
I know.
Brilliant.
I know.
Well, I have to say, you know, having told me that originally it was just going to be about your mother's memories, and looking at what it is now, you know, you've seen these areas throughout the decades, and we see this transformation. It really adds that other layer to it. You know, for anyone who's interested in history, as well as, you know, a traveller and sort of scratching beneath the surface of this popular tourism destination. So I really do think it adds another layer with how it ended up, the end result we have. So we'll go to the start of it. You were shipped off there, as you say, in 1976 by your parents. So your parents both came from Yugoslavia, as it was then, and you were shipped off there for a summer. You were 11 at the time, and you were a bit traumatised by the experience, weren't you? And I found that rather funny as well, you know, the language barrier, the toilets, the food. So just, you know, talk me through that experience a bit.
I'm the youngest of three and the only girl. So you can imagine what a spoilt little princess I was. And I was staying with my aunt and uncle for the summer, and I met them like once, and I didn't really know them. I'd never been away from my family, from my parents like that, and stuck in the middle of a mountain village with very primitive plumbing and everything. And I thought I'd spoken Serbian, but my parents were ethnic Serbs from in an enclave in Croatia. And so Serbian was actually my mother tongue, but I obviously, you know, it got a lot more English had crept into it than I had realized. And that was the language barrier to begin with. And I couldn't understand my cousins, they couldn't understand me. But, you know, kids' brains are like sponges, and that is true. And I, within a very short period of time, my Serbian had picked up hugely. I was dreaming and thinking in Serbian by the end of that summer. And a total immersion works. But it was really, it was difficult. The landscapes were so wild. it was all mountainous and forests and huge fields and waterfalls and rivers. And yeah, it was not traumatized. It was just completely alien to me. And it was difficult to grasp just in the huge scale of these mountains and everything. But again, they grew on me and I just absolutely fell in love with all the landscapes, which is why I keep going back to Lika every few years. I go more often if I could, because the mountains, they've made what the people of Lika are. You know, they are mountain people, quite stubborn and strong and tapasol boots. But the landscapes really are just beautiful. I can't get enough of them.
No, I just think that part of the world, all those mountain landscapes in that part of the world, they're just next level, aren't they? And the lakes and the rivers as well, as you describe in your book, you know, a blue green like no other. It's just stunning. I mean, Google some photos if you're listening, you won't regret it. It's just absolutely beautiful. And before we continue on, we should probably give this a little bit of context. So when you visited in the 70s, this was still Yugoslavia. Could you just explain briefly what happened during the 90s in Yugoslavia?
Right, well, it's a very, very convoluted and very complicated history, but I'll try hard to be brief. Essentially, when Tito died in 1980, the Confederation of the Six Republics was slowly falling apart. The country was falling apart. And by the time 1991 came along, Slovenia said, we've had enough of this. They were pretty much the richest republic. And Croatia very swiftly followed. And essentially, the head of Serbia, the president, was Milosevic. And he essentially wanted to take over. He wanted power for himself. At the same time, Franjo Tuđman, who was the president of Croatia, he was also, you know, the two of them together were working. They were stoking up a lot of nationalistic rhetoric and instilling fear. And the idea of Croatia breaking away from Yugoslavia filled the Serbian minority with fear. And because they thought, we're going to be losing our rights, we'll become a minority. And so they didn't want to be part of an independent Croatia. And unfortunately, because of everything that was all the nationalistic rhetoric and just fear-mongering, I mean, the Serbian television was broadcasting all these, you know, these documentaries about the Second World War, because the last time Croatia was independent in the 1940s, they were when Nazi Germany invaded in 1941. I did say it was convoluted. I'm not being very brief. I do apologize, but there's so much to get in there. So last time that, you know, Croatia was independent, it was ruled by a Nazi puppet state, a fascist state, ruled by the Ustasha, who then systematically went about murdering Serbs, Jews and Roma. So obviously the Serbs in Croatia were very, very worried about that. And that then eventually led to fighting between two. The Yugoslav National Army was brought in as a buffer. They then became pretty much a Serbian army. And the fighting was really absolutely, utterly brutal and unspeakably brutal. And, you know, Serbs were ethnically cleansing Croatian villages and Serbian villages had that happen to them as well. And it was only until 1995 when the war in Bosnia had finished, because that had also started from 1992, that Croatia was then able to regroup and then essentially retake the lands that Serbian fighters and also the Serbian paramilitaries, nasty lot, had taken from Croatia. And then that's why you had this mass exodus of Serbs from Croatia, more than 200,000 people. And so that put a huge hole in the fabric of what was Croatia, because the Serbs had been there for hundreds of years.
Yeah, you did fairly well to keep that quite compressed, so don't worry. It's just, you know, to provide context, you know, this is what's happening. And, you know, the first time you went to Yugoslavia, all of this was in the future. You didn't know it's going to happen. How did it affect your family?
Well, my family, my father left in, he left in 1944 and ended up in eventually after several years in refugee camps in London. And my mother left in 1955 and she also came to London. That's where they met and that's where they got married. And my father, unfortunately, he died in 1989. So he never lived to see what happened to Yugoslavia. And my mother, she wasn't, you know, she was anti-Tito. She didn't want to live in a communist country. So she was able to leave in 1955 to come to England. And they weren't fans of the communist government. They didn't approve of Tito. And but as I said, it wasn't an issue for my father. And as I said, my mother's been back, you know, quite a few times. She was there in 1980, actually literally like a month after he died. eat or die, and then went back quite a few times. So she just, you know, picks up as normal. And obviously she's got fewer cousins and relations actually in Lika, because most of them are in Belgrade. So she goes, she combines both places.
And what about the family that you met in the 70s? You know, how did it impact them? I think I read that, you know, you didn't really hear much from them. You didn't know whether they were dead or alive at one point. So to make, you know, to connect with these family members in the 70s and to have a long summer with them, and then suddenly, you know, as a child or a young person as well, to think you've not heard from them, you don't know what's happening, you know, how does that impact you and how were they impacted?
It was very difficult, it being in the 90s, not knowing anything, because as my father had died and I lost a lot of communication with certain parts of the family. They just, the links just disappeared. And, you know, 1991, 92, it wasn't, you didn't have the internet. You didn't have, it was difficult to find out anything about my family there. And most of them, either they fled in around 1991 and they went to Belgrade, they went to the influx of Serbs from Croatia. They were in places like Austria, Switzerland, Germany, London. London was full of Serbs who from Lika who just did not, they didn't want a part of that. They didn't want to fight that war. A lot of them, you know, were in Belgrade, or they went to Canada, a lot in Canada as well. And in 1995, again, there was the exodus of Serbs, and some were able to come back and others weren't. So I discovered that one aunt and uncle and my cousins, they ended up in northern Serbia, and two of my cousins being in Belgrade. And I was able to track them down, which was wonderful, because I really had no idea what had happened to them. But other members of my family, I still don't really know. I mean, as I said, sometimes, you know, if all it takes is having two parts of family who don't really speak to each other, and then you don't know what's happened to them. But others, I know that they are safe and well. And, you know, there's obviously a lot of the population who I knew as a child, and they were just elderly. They just died, you know, just of old age.
Yeah, well, that's good to hear that the majority that you met are safe and well. That's really good to hear. And Lika itself, you said when you first visited, you know, it was kind of propped up on foreign money. You felt like there was a bit of a visage there. How did Lika change, or what differences were there between, you know, when it was in Yugoslavia and afterwards, after the 1990s? How did it change?
Well, the way that the government was run, like a lot of other communist countries, well, especially Yugoslavia, it essentially was foreign loans. They were living on foreign loans, and they had a sort of a false picture of what the economy was like. State-run industries, absolutely everywhere. Everyone had a job. But of course, as soon as the government fell apart, so did all these state-run industries. There was no one to run them anymore. They couldn't afford them. So unfortunately, a lot of the industry, and there were quite a few factories in Lika, they just all closed down. So you had a lot of people leaving the region because they were looking for work in the cities. They go to Zagreb, they go to Rijeka, they go to Belgrade. So it was always a rural society, but they did have some light industrial works there. And there is now, to a lesser extent, but it's mainly an agricultural society.
So let's talk a little bit more about Lika as a destination then. I feel like we've spoken a lot about the history of it. And of course, that's very important to get the context of the book. But, you know, tell me a little bit about the culture there. How's it been influenced by all of this history? What's it like? You know, the landscapes you're talking about as well. What was it like taking your mum there?
Well, it's very rustic. There aren't any cities at all. The largest town, Gospić, is 6,500 people. And it's mainly, you know, small villages, hamlets, you know, these scattered settlements, a lot of mountains, a lot of rivers, and a lot of every village, every house has a vegetable plot or a small holding, people growing their own food all the time. As far as sort of the tourist side of things, the biggest thing in Lika is the Plitvice Lakes National Park. And that is a massive draw. It's one of the biggest tourist attractions in Croatia. And it's a huge money spinner. It's spawned in a very large industry around it, tourism industry. And lots of accommodation, lots of restaurants and tourist agencies, you know, servicing the hundreds of thousands of people who visit every year, millions. And that's pretty much, that keeps on mushrooming further and further out, because there's only three hotels in Plitvice within the national park, three official hotels. Everyone else is outside the park boundaries. And that just keeps on mushrooming because people want to come. And then they realize, you know, within the national park, you go there for a day, you might go there for a couple of days, but then all around the area, you've got more rivers, you've got, you know, more walking, you could cycling, and rafting and kayaking both become really popular adventure activities because you've got the Una River and the waterfalls. And that sort of smaller scale tourism is a really important part now of Lika, because it does get people there, it keeps people living there who can then run these activities and these small agencies. And it really takes people away from the honeypot that's Plitvice Lakes itself, because there's a lot of land there. there's a lot of space. You have a lot of empty landscapes and lots of lovely walking that in recent years they've marked the trails, they've got walking maps, they've got cycling maps. And that's taken a bit of time to do that because there's just all tourism infrastructure that needs building.
And has Lika been able to benefit from some of this? I know it's been impacted a lot during the pandemic, like a lot of places have, but it's been able to benefit. And have you seen that transformation over the decades?
Well, yes. Every time I went, you have like one village B&B, and the next time you go, there's like four or five. A lot more people are running, small guest houses or renting their rooms. A lot more of these small agencies doing all the active holidays, which is that is such a popular thing now. And more restaurants and smaller hotels. And it's one way of keeping that economy, thriving, or not thriving, but keeping it going.
Mm-hmm. And I can imagine it's still quite, although, it is attracting tourists now, it's still quite rustic. It's off the beaten path, for those who want to get away from the throngs.
Oh, definitely. Yes. you've got other parts, not the areas that I grew up in. You've got Fotochats, which is, sort of further to the west, which is all, lovely Habsburg architecture and the Gutska River and the valley. And you've got those areas which are slightly more, not sophisticated isn't the word, it's just it's less rustic, but it's not a very tamed landscape in a way. There's just so much empty space, and so a lot of room for everyone to enjoy.
Yeah, and that is what I love when I travel. I always look for those places off the beaten path, and I'm sure many of my listeners do as well, so it's always worth knowing about those places and know where to go and put your money somewhere else, somewhere that needs more money, not just the big tourist attractions. So yeah, really, really great. And you said actually we're talking about the lakes there. You said in your book, I'm just going to quote this now, "The Yugoslavia I left behind in 1976 was an illusion whose economy was propped up by foreign loans that gave a false picture of prosperity. Yugoslavs had the freedom to travel, which made them the envy of their neighbours who were corralled into the Soviet bloc. But they also had political prisoners and purges, state-sanctioned murders, secret police, corruption, and a president whose death 4 years later was the beginning of the end of Yugoslavia. As we got to know Plitvice," is it Plitvice?
Plitvice.
Plitvice, oh, my pronunciation's awful. "Over the next couple of days, a few pieces of the 1990s war fell into place." And I just thought that was such a fantastic bit of writing. I'd just like to ask, what exactly did you mean by that? What parts of the war fell into place, and what can, those who want to really delve into the history of this area and not just admire the pretty view, what can they notice, what can they look for and experience?
Well, you still have houses that show mortar damage, bomb damage, burnt a lot because they were torched. Some houses were torched by the Serbs in 1991, and other Serbian houses were then torched by the Croats in 1995. So there's a lot of that scorched earth policy, unfortunately. And so you will see some places will still have that. And other places you'll see graffiti written, not graffiti, but you'll see, "Please don't burn my house. This is a Croatian house, don't burn it." But it's one of those things where you don't want to go looking for that, because that sort of gets into the whole area of dark tourism, which I don't think it's, you want to see the beauty. You don't want to see that there are scars. The scars of war are still there. And as long as Lika remains the rural society that it is, because it does have it's had the same sort of problem with emigration that the rest of Croatia has had. Young people leave Croatia to go to Germany, to go to Ireland, a lot of other places. But you can still find these places. But also you'll find abandoned buildings that just hadn't been lived in and were just left to crumble. My mother's old house, no one's lived there since 1990 or 1989, I think. And there's hardly anything left of it because no one's lived there. It was never shelled or torched because it was a ruin when, pretty much nearly, soon after the war started.
Amazing. And a good point you made there about, dark tourism. We don't really want to shine a light on that in this area. But yeah, just found that really interesting. So, you've returned to Lika over the decades. And I often think that if you get the chance to return to a place, it's like watching a complex film again. Each time you notice something different, or you have a different memory, or no, you know, experience something different. So, you know, did you experience that each time you went back? How did it change? What was good? What was bad?
Yeah, so I did actually. Every time I went, it was interesting because up until 2009, I'd been there with my mother the second two times I was there. And then subsequent four or five visits was with my husband. And that's when the shift in the book changes slightly from travelogue and memoir to more travelogue. And there's much more of a travel element in there because I'm essentially introducing my English husband to my family's home, my family's heritage. And he was absolutely loving it because we traveled in the Balkans before and he couldn't get enough of it either. But each time as I get older, you know, appreciating simpler things, appreciating simple beauties, and eating food that was growing all around us, and having a wild boar stew that was shot by my uncle's friend, and you know, stewing in the pot, and fish that was he got from the trout farm, like literally 300 meters from his house, and grilling it, and just really simple pleasures like that, and just it was the things like the food and this sharing of the food. And eating and drinking and, you know, the schlievelbitza and the beer going and just, you know, fun times and just having it but in this beautiful, peaceful place, you know, it is now. And that's just one of the things I appreciate more as I get older.
Absolutely. And appreciate more the more you see it, I suppose, as well. Fantastic. It sounds like a really blissful place to visit. So we've talked a lot about, you know, Leica and this area, because of course you are an expert in it. You've visited it a lot. But I wondered if you could just tell us a little bit about some of Croatia's other hidden gems. You know, for anybody looking to go to Croatia, where can they go to get off the beaten path?
Well, quite a few places, loads of places, but mainly within the hinterland. Just south of Leica, you go into northern Dalmatia, and you've got a town called Knin, which unfortunately had suffered very badly in 1995, but it's now actually seen as the gateway to the Dinara Nature Park, it's the newest nature park designated in Croatia just last year, I believe. And or was it this year? Can't remember. Anyway, it's the newest one. And it's got Croatia's highest peak and it borders with Bosnia. And wonderful hiking there. And you've got the spring of the Cetina River just north of Knin as well, which is an astonishing looking place. And so all along the Cetina River, people then go, you know, they use the river, they go kayaking and rafting. And that eventually empties out into Omiš along the Adriatic coast, which is a very, you know, beautiful place and popular place to go to. And then going further west, one of the places I've been to quite a few times are the villages around the Karinsko More, which is a little inland sea, but connected by a channel, which flows into the Adriatic just north of Zadar. And Zadar has become, a really popular place, and a lot of cruise liners dock there. But it's also, I mean, it's a beautiful place, and I've been there quite a few times and really enjoy going there. But all the places in the hinterland above it, the landscapes there, they're very scrubby, they're very barren, but they're beautiful. You've got the Velebit mountain range that's there, and that then goes into Paklenica National Park, which has got, you know, we went hiking there, beautiful hiking. And all along the Velebit mountain range, you've got fantastic hiking and climbing, rock climbing as well.
That sounds incredible. Lots of places to go and get lost then by the sounds of it, and to escape the tourist crowds. Lovely. Now, I wondered if we could just mention your mum a little bit. She plays a huge part in this book, and you shared a very special adventure with her. Unfortunately, she has dementia now. But, you know, with how she is now, how important was it to have done this book and to have these experiences with her? What are some of your fondest memories?
It's quite an astonishing thing, actually, because it was such a difficult and bad-tempered time. So much of that trip with her, we were just yelling at each other. We were just fireworks going off all the time because you've got two equally stubborn women who want to have their own way, essentially. And it had some really difficult times, but also it was wonderful, especially with hindsight, getting her memories, being with her, sharing these moments from her life. And that's something I always treasure, and I'm just happy I've been able to put in the book. She will never be able to read it, unfortunately, and it is difficult now because what's happened with her personality is that she's become incredibly sweet, and she was never quite that sweet before. We've both had a bit of a a bit of a rocky relationship before, and but she's, you know, really very sweet and charming. We're on the phone, and she says, you know, I say, well, I love you, Mum, and she says, I love you more. And she'd never said that before. So
did she used to be quite feisty? I get that impression from the book that she could have been quite feisty.
Quite feisty is one way of putting it, yes. Yes.
Lovely. Yeah. Love it. Love a good feisty character. It's great. Finally then, I just wanted to let you know, what I got from the book was you started with the Ritzy Lakes. Yes, I got it right. You know, you started the kind of...
Pete Pizza.
Yeah, my pronunciation is awful. Do excuse me. But, you know, you started there, which was it's a huge tourism trap. And what I love is that you know, immediately took us, you scratched beneath the surface and you took us to a very personal Croatia, a Croatia that's seen a lot of history, not all of it good. But despite that, you still managed to, you know, bring through some light, some laughter. You know, I laughed at, you know, all the little language barriers, all the little funny moments, the fights of your mum. And, you know, you brought us to a very personal Croatia and, you know, a real Croatia, I think. So anybody who, you know, is looking to go to Croatia and to get off the beaten path and to see a bit of the real part of Croatia, then you see it in your memoir. And, you know, I think as well, it makes you think that when you travel to places with a history like Croatia has, it's important to know that and to understand it and not just take it at face value. Now, was that one of your intentions when you wrote this?
Well, absolutely, yes, because people think of Croatia, they think of the Adriatic coast, they go to Dubrovnik, or they go to Split, they go to Istria. And if they do head inland, they'll go to Krka National Park, more waterfalls there, or they go to Plitvice, and they go to Zagreb, of course. But all those huge swathes of land in between, they're pretty much not even noticed. People don't even know they're there unless they're sitting on a coach going through it. And that's as much of the heart of Croatia as anything else.
Absolutely. And that definitely comes through. Mary, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast and chatting about your book and your adventures and sharing a little bit about your mum there as well. Best of luck with the launch. I look forward to seeing it out on the shelves. And where to next? I forgot to ask you that. I always ask my guests this. What have you got coming up next?
I have absolutely no idea. I'm trying to keep some time set aside for to promote the book, so I can't really plan anything until we get more of an idea of what the schedule is going to be like. But I'm dying to get away.
Yes, absolutely. Brilliant. Well, thank you so much, Mary. It's been great speaking to you.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me, Laura.